Good evening, everyone. The topic for tonight is Mordechai Vanunu, nuclear whistleblower, traitor, and apostate. So before we can discuss the life of Mordechai Vanunu, who is the first character we're assessing who is still amongst the living, he's very much alive. We're going to discuss the Israeli nuclear program in general in order to understand why someone might be opposed to it. Israel began its quest for nuclear weapons immediately after the War of Independence. In 1949, already David Ben-Gurion had in mind that Israel should become a nuclear power. Why? Well, a few reasons. Number one is this attitude of never again, that the Jewish people should not be led to the slaughter, and if they were a Jewish state was a nuclear weaponized state, then no one could push them around. But practically speaking, what was the strategy? What was the military strategy of having nuclear weapons?
Get them before you get.
So one approach is that it is a deterrent against aggressive maneuvers by larger neighboring Arab states that might be inclined to attack civilian targets within the state of Israel and inflict massive casualties. For example, aerial bombardment of Tel Aviv with hundreds or thousands of deaths. That has never happened. I mean, in the 48 war, to a very limited extent, there was that, but weaponry had not advanced that far that you could kill as many as in later decades, as would take place, let's say, in Beirut. In Israel's wars with Lebanon, you know, many, many people died. The casualty count is infinitely higher than it is in Israeli wars on Israeli soil. So this idea, if we have a nuclear weapon, they can't do that to us. Even if we go to war, there will be limits upon their behavior. But not that it was a first strike option. At best, it would be a second strike option. The other approach is to say, what if Israel actually loses a war, or is on the verge of losing a war? That only really happened once, in 1973, between about October 8th and October 13th, days, 3 through 7 of the war, when things looked pretty bleak, before the airlift, when on the Golan Heights, there were 6 tanks facing down 200 tanks, and even in the Sinai, things didn't look all that comfortable. So there's the possibility of Operation Samson. If we're going to go down, everyone else goes down too. We're going to lose, but everyone else is going to die. So unlike Masada, where only the good guys die, in Operation Samson, like in the story of the Philistine stadium, Tamud Nafshim Plishtim, I shall die with the Philistines.
Bring down the house.
Those are some of the theories of Israeli nuclear weapons. But you need help to get nuclear weapons. Israel's a small country. Population in the late 40s, early 50s, around a million, million and a half, after the massive influx from the Arab states. It's a poor country. It's a socialist country. It doesn't have the material resources to commit to this kind of project. I mean, it's busy absorbing refugees from all around the world. How are you going to pay for and access the materials, the physical materials needed for nuclear weapons? So, on the financial angle, it is claimed that the nuclear project cost about $80 million to get off the ground, which is a lot of money by Israeli standards of those years, and that about half of that money was donated by private individuals in the Jewish diaspora at the request of David Ben-Gurion himself. That's what it is claimed. All right. Whether that can't be corroborated because no one has admitted to personally giving money for this project. But that's what all the history books say is true. There's no plaque. There's no plaque at Dimona. Mr. Goldberg doesn't have his name on the bomb. What about the physical materials and the knowledge? So Israel's great ally in the quest for nuclear weapons throughout the 1950s was France. Why France? Well, France was the fourth nuclear state. If the United States in 1945 exploded bombs, first at in the western desert on July 17th as a test run, and then Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Soviet Union in 1949, the British in 1952, the French eventually in 1960 would explode their first nuclear weapon. But throughout the 1950s, they were working on it. And they believed that Jewish scientists would lead the way in providing the French with the nuclear know-how. Bear in mind that Einstein, Teller, and Oppenheimer were the key figures in the American quest for a nuclear bomb. So the Jews know physics, and therefore utilize the surviving European Jewish physicists, many of whom were French nationals, but also secure the cooperation of the Israelis, who likely likely have top-flight scientists out of Rehovot, out of the Weizmann Institute. They did. Ernst Bergman, who was the head of the Israeli Atomic Energy Cooperation or Association from 1952 to 1966, was a major scientist. And this cooperation was fruitful for both sides. Israel gained know-how. The French gained know-how. But Israel also gained access to raw materials and money. The French were the key figures in the building of the nuclear facility at Dimona in 1957-58. But that actually wasn't Israel's first nuclear facility. In 1955, President Eisenhower made a speech known as the Atoms for Peace speech. This has not gone down in history as being all that important, but basically it was the United States' attempt to spread peaceful nuclear know-how to non-nuclear states in the hopes that it would divert attention from the nuclear Cold War standoff, that other states could have access to knowledge but to be used only for benign purposes, nothing weaponized. Who took advantage of U.S. offers of assistance? Israel, Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan. Not exactly a great company, but on the basis of that cooperation, limited cooperation, Israel built a nuclear facility at Nachal Sorek, which is not far from Tel Aviv, in the middle of the country, and it was a diversion. It was a diversionary tactic to get people focused on that facility, which legitimately had peaceful research intentions, and that people should not think about what's going on to the south and to the east near Dimona in the Negev. Well, in 1958, Israel begins construction of the site at Dimona. Who does the work? Sephardic Jews, mostly Iraqi Jews, recent arrivals who had no marketable skills other than raw physical labor, and they could be paid a pittance. But because Israel had strong labor unions, it was important that they only work 59 hours a week and not the requisite 60 hours, because then they would be entitled to benefits. And there would have to be a record of their work. So off the books, the government employed thousands of new immigrants to dig a big hole in the ground in the Negev without telling anyone what the purpose was. Okay. One of the reasons why the French cooperated on this project was a bit of Holocaust guilt, that the Jews of Europe had been slaughtered, and the French felt that they owed it to the Jewish state to make sure that doesn't happen again. Prime Minister Guy Mollet, who was prime minister in 55-56 after, at the time of the Suez Affair, he had a soft spot in his heart for the state of Israel. Also, Israel's cooperation in the Suez Affair was something that the French and the British couldn't take for granted. They wanted to retake the canal zone, which had been their property and had been nationalized by the Egyptians. But they needed a pretext to serve as the world's policeman, and the pretext was an Arab-Israeli war. So Israel had to invade Egypt and occupy portions of the Sinai in order for international colonial powers to put their boots on the ground in the Northern Canal Zone. All this was negotiated by Shimon Peres, representing David Ben-Gurion in the suburbs of Paris in the last 2 weeks of October of 1956. How do you pronounce S-E-V-R-E-S?
Sever.
Sever. Sèvres. Okay. I asked our resident Frenchman how to pronounce that. Okay, so that was the protocols of October 23rd of 1956. And the secret addendum to the protocols was that France would cooperate on Israel's nuclear project. Okay. In 1958, that cooperation takes a turn for the worse with the arrival of Charles de Gaulle as president of France, who doesn't like the Jews and doesn't like the state of Israel and will have a hostile relationship with Israel for the next decade. But somehow, Israel was able to maintain cooperation with French bureaucrats, either unbeknownst to de Gaulle or in direct contravention of his wishes. And this cooperation continued below the radar until 1966. Somehow, they were able to pull that off. The British also cooperated on the nuclear project in supplying heavy water to Israel. Why the British were involved, I'm still not quite sure what was in it for them, especially considering a pretty hostile relationship that the British had with Israel in general after the establishment of the state in 48, other than a brief moment of cooperation in 56. I don't know why in the early 60s the British were cooperative, but they were, to an extent, in supplying the water. The real concern, though, was the relationship between Israel and the United States. U-2 spy planes flew over Dimona in 1960 and saw something that attracted the attention or aroused the suspicion of the American intelligence establishment. And President Eisenhower sent a letter to David Ben-Gurion demanding clarification of what is this project you have going on in the Negev. But that letter was basically ignored. Ben-Gurion could afford to ignore that letter, in part because Eisenhower's term of office was expiring very shortly, and also because Israel was not yet beholden to the United States as an arms supplier of any magnitude. The relationship had not yet flowered to the extent that it is today or has been for the last 50 years. But the next administration took a very hard line. The relationship between President Kennedy and the State of Israel is a complex one. Several books have been written about that relationship. And some areas, the relations were good. And I think Kennedy's heart was in the right place. He was mainly concerned with preventing the spread of nuclear conflict on account of the Cold War. He feared additional nuclear standoffs, the likes of the Cuban Missile Crisis of 62. So he didn't want this technology in the hands of other states. And Israel, whether he liked Israel or didn't like Israel, didn't want Israel to have a nuclear weapon. So he is adamant that there needs to be inspections of the facility at Dimona by an international team. Ben-Gurion refuses. This refusal results in Ben-Gurion not being granted a White House meeting with President Kennedy. It never happened. They did meet one time at the Waldorf Astoria during UN Week of 1961, but never at the White House. That was the official snub. Yeah.
What's the ramification of not meeting, as opposed to meeting?
You know, in the world of high diplomacy, people care about these things. For your average citizen, your average Chaim Yankel, it doesn't matter at all. But when you're that important, you care about these things. Yeah.
Was the United States similarly concerned about Turkey and Pakistan and Iran?
Not yet, because those countries were not yet pursuing these sorts of things. It would be many years later that the Iranians would advance their program, and the Pakistanis even later than the Pakistanis by the late 80s, early 90s were moving rapidly towards a weapon. The Indians were the first non-proliferation treaty member to explode a weapon. They did that in 1974. The treaty was signed or went into effect in 1970, and there are five official nuclear powers: the United States, the Soviet Union / Russia, the British, the French, and the Chinese. But that's all it's supposed to be. Subsequent to 1970, the Indians did it in 74, the Pakistanis did it, I think, in 97 or 98, and the North Koreans in 2006, and Israel never, which we'll get to. But those are the nine nuclear states. So Kennedy is pushing, yeah.
Is there a particular reason why de Gaulle did not like the Jews?
You don't really need a reason for a Frenchman, for a French nationalist to be anti-Jewish. It's like a Dreyfus era holdover. You know, people don't like Jews. So Kennedy's adamant you need to have inspections. But refusal after refusal. In 1963, you have the last refusal by Ben-Gurion. And then both Ben-Gurion and Kennedy are out of power. Ben-Gurion is forced into retirement by the Mapai over issues of the Lavon affair, and just he's getting old and they want new leadership, and Kennedy is assassinated. So the next players on the scene are Lyndon Johnson and Levi Eshkol. And Levi Eshkol cut a deal with a State Department functionary whereby it was agreed that Israel would not be the first country in the Middle East to introduce nuclear weapons to the region. That is a very weird term, to introduce nuclear weapons, and it has been variously interpreted by different parties over the years. One interpretation of it is Israel will not be the first country in the Middle East to have nuclear weapons. But that's not the only possible interpretation. That might be the most obvious one, the most literal one, but it's not the only one. Another possible interpretation is Israel will not be the first to explode a nuclear weapon, in the sense that either through testing or through use in combat, it isn't going to be the first one to do it. Alternatively, Israel will not be the first one to produce a usable weapon, even if it might have the technology and the know-how to rapidly put one into effect, because you could be a nuclear state and have all the component parts but not bother to assemble a bomb because you don't feel as though you need to use it anytime soon. So there are a whole range of ways of interpreting this, but it satisfied the Johnson administration. And it made Israel look good, and it was a nice way of avoiding having to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Israel said was not in its national security interest. So you don't sign the treaty, but you say we're not going to do it. It's a promise, it's an amorphous promise, while not putting pen to paper on the treaty that it was binding to 100 and some odd other countries. Okay. The policy that you're probably all familiar with is that of nuclear ambiguity or nuclear opacity. Ambiguity was an arrangement between Golda Meir and Richard Nixon in 1969. And it actually is the result of I wouldn't call it the evil genius, but the genius of Henry Kissinger, who was at that time National Security Advisor. Nixon was annoyed that Israel was being deceptive about its nuclear ambitions. What kind of deception did it engage in? Well, starting in 1964, there were inspections. The Americans had insisted upon it, and it was going to happen, and it did happen. But Israel agreed on condition that they not be IAEA inspectors, International Atomic Energy Inspectors, but rather an American team, and that the American team will arrive after giving due notice of several weeks, and that certain aspects of the facility, which are too dangerous, would not be entered. So this is like Iran in 2013 and Iraq in 2002. So when you say these sorts of things, it's obvious you're hiding something. But the Americans went along with it. Knowing that they're being deceived, but it's a charade that you have to go through, you have to play. Okay, so this goes on, 64, 65, 66. The historians or the military experts who look on things in hindsight claim that by December of 66, Israel did have a usable weapon, and that on June 5th, 1967, when the Six-Day War began, Israel had two crude weapons that were roughly the equivalent of 19 kilotons, around the same thing as the Nagasaki bomb. Some claim they had as many as 13 usable weapons, although I think that's an inflated number. Two seems more reasonable. Others say they actually didn't have one, but we'll never know.
When did they test the bomb in South
Africa? We're going to get to that soon. We're going to get to that soon. 1979. So, Israel has these weapons, and by 1968, it is assumed by all branches of the United States federal government, State Department, Defense Department, that Israel has at least a few weapons at its disposal. So in 69, Nixon wants better information about this, an honest version of Israel's military standing in the world. And so Kissinger says to him, listen, the Israelis don't want to give up their secrets, and you want information. If you press them very hard, well, you might get them to change their policy. But how are you going to press them? On matters of defense, of providing of weapons, military aid. Well, if you withhold something like an F-4, F-16, F-35, whatever it is you're going to withhold, they're going to leak that to the press. The Israelis will. And if the Israelis leak it to the press is going to want to know why you are withholding significant military assistance that was promised. And your only answer is going to be because they're being dishonest about their nuclear program. But you don't want the public to know, the general public, the world, the community to know that they have a nuclear program. Therefore, we're stuck. We're in a bind here. The only solution is for there to be an agreement that Israel doesn't test weapons, but yet gets to keep them, and they stay mum on the subject, ambiguity, and we say nothing as well. That's the best the Americans could hope for under the gaming scenario that Kissinger played out for Nixon.
How's that different from with Johnson? We won't introduce. I mean, isn't that
so? It's the same thing as we won't introduce, except as it became apparent to more and more people that Israel really had something behind the curtain. Ambiguity means we're not going to say, we're not going to deny, we're not going to say yes, as opposed to not introducing, which is more of a denial. So now it's like less of a denial, without an admission. It's not even a modus mixus. Okay. So, what about the testing of a weapon? So, when the French tested their bomb in 1960, the French perspective on it was that it was much an Israeli test as it was a French test, in the sense that the knowledge gleaned from that experiment was made available to Israeli scientists just as well as it was to the French scientists. And so Israel learned so much to advance their own cause of nuclear weaponization that arguably they didn't even need to have their own test. But some say there was a test in the Negev in 1966 of a nuclear bomb that had a zero yield. I'm no scientist, so I don't know what that means, a zero yield. There was no radiation, there was no cloud. I don't know what that means, but something exploded that was useful in determining whether or not a certain weapon could function in a battle scenario.
Is that how they got
them? Huh? Okay, so the last test of significance is September 22nd, 1979, which was mentioned before, the South Africans. We don't know that a test actually occurred on that date. All we know is that United States satellite imaging saw something in the South Indian Ocean that looked like either a massive seismic event or a nuclear explosion. It was known as the Vela incident. Is that blip on the satellite imaging associated with Israel and South Africa? Well, because it was not far from South Africa, and South Africa was a nuclear threshold state at that time, and eventually did develop several nuclear weapons, which they decommissioned and got rid of before the apartheid regime collapsed, which was a very important thing for the world, that those weapons were done away with. Okay, just like in the case of the Soviet Union collapse, that the weapons went back into the hands of the Russian state, as opposed to Ukraine or the Caucasus.
That's what they
wanted. Well, so South Africa may have been involved. what's the connection to Israel? There had long been suspicion of Israeli and South African collaboration on nuclear projects on, and in general on military affairs, which gave Israel a black eye on the world stage because the South African regime, the apartheid regime, was being delegitimized by countries around the world for its racist policies. But Israel, suffering as it did in the post-67 and especially post-73 era of not having even diplomatic relations with the Soviet bloc, with some of the African states, some of the Latin American states, it needed friends wherever it could find them. And so, yes, there was cooperation between State of Israel and apartheid South Africa in the late 70s, early 80s. There's no denying it. But did they cooperate in a nuclear explosion? I don't know. More recent assessment of that episode tends to doubt whether it was a nuclear bomb. Earlier assessments and judgments from like the 1990s and early 2000s had been pretty conclusive that it was a bomb, but more recently people tend to doubt that. Okay. So, more recently than that, in 2006, there was an unfortunate episode in which Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, not exactly a real hero of Am Yisrael at this point, made a mistake. And some of you might have even seen or heard that mistake, you know, on live television. He was speaking about the Iranian quest for nuclear weapons and said that they couldn't be trusted to be a responsible possessor of weapons of mass destruction along the lines of the Americans, the Chinese, the Israelis, and the Russians. The fact that he threw in Israel was a gaffe. He wasn't supposed to say that, and he did. And he later had to have his press secretary backtrack and say he didn't really mean it like that. It made all sorts of bogus retractions, but he messed up. And if you go back to certain, I was reading this afternoon, as I was preparing, I was reading the Haaretz opinion pieces and the Jerusalem Post pieces from December of 2006, basically calling for his resignation, that if he's such a fool and incompetent that he can't keep this secret to himself, then what is he doing being the Prime Minister of the state? Okay. Now let's go to Mordechai Vanunu. Yeah.
In Michelle Golda, they during 73.
Right, they take her to the basement.
Right, and they talk about that she was thinking of using
the
nuclear option.
Right.
Is there any truth, or is that just historical fiction?
I don't know. I tend to doubt that it was as close to happening as the show depicts. I saw that show on Broadway with Tova Feldshuh. Because it came back. I saw it in the first go-around, like 11, 12 years ago, and I remember coughing because she actually smokes on stage. And I think at that time it was legal. Now I think it's illegal. But I was sitting in the front row, and she was smoking right on me.
But it was a well-known scene. Essentially, everybody knew who had it. It's just that you don't say it.
You don't say it. You don't say it. You don't say it. The one thing that is still very ambiguous and people don't know, other than the defense establishment itself, is how many weapons Israel has. By the 1980s, it was estimated that Israel had about 200 nuclear warheads. Jimmy Carter said it's 300, but then again, Jimmy Carter is in the business of giving Israel a black eye any way he can. Okay, now to Vanunu. Mordechai Vanunu was born in 1954 in Morocco. He comes to Israel at the age of 8 in 1963 with his parents. Poor family, as were most of the Jews in Morocco, comes and lives in Be'er Sheva, in a shanty town, no electricity even where he lives. A very impoverished existence. His father is a very religious man, sends Mordechai off to the yeshiva, and supposedly, and we don't know this to be true, maybe Vanunu is lying about it years later, but Vanunu says that he had an epiphany that Judaism was a false religion, and he turned away from God when he was in high school, but he didn't want to say anything because he didn't want to offend his father. Okay, let's leave it at that. He graduates high school, gets drafted into the military. He wants to be a pilot. He gets rejected from being a pilot. He becomes a sapper. And in 1973, he serves in the Golan Heights in the Yom Kippur War. He's honorably discharged in 1975, although there was an offer for him to be a career soldier, which he declined. He goes to college at Tel Aviv University, but he kind of drops out. He fails out because he's busy working simultaneously. He can't do both at one time. In 1976, he applies for a job at the nuclear research facility in Dimona, and after lengthy questioning and training, he's accepted, and he works at Dimona from 1976 to 1985 for a period of 9 years. During that time, he also goes to college at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, and he majors in geography and philosophy, graduating with a BA in 1985. During his years of work, he also became known as a far-left activist in the student organizations. He opposed the 1982 Lebanon War, but then again so did everyone. But he was known for having very pro-Arab views at a time when that was not the norm. I mean, he was ahead of his time in being very pro-PLO and generally pro-Arab and hostile to his own country. Okay, so his handlers or his supervisors at Dimona were suspicious that maybe he no longer is an appropriate employee for such a sensitive position, and he was questioned multiple times. He was even fired at one point, not because of his political views, but simply because of layoffs, but the union got his job back. In 1985, he quit, and he decided to travel the world. But before deciding to travel the world, while he was still working there, he did something very sneaky. He suspected that this was a place not just for scientific research, but that there was the production of weapons in a subterranean basement. He worked on the fifth floor, but the exciting stuff was on the sixth and seventh floor. So you can't go there if you don't work there. But he worked the night shift, and the supervisor one time accidentally left the keys to the elevator in the locker room. And he snuck with the keys, went to the lower floor when nobody was looking, and he took rolls of film. So now he has evidence of the component parts of weapons, the kinds of photographs that, if inspected by an expert, would clearly reveal that Israel has bombs. I mean, a layperson might look at it and not know what they're looking at, but someone who knows what they're doing would clearly know. Well, he doesn't get the film developed right away. He holds on to it. Not sure why he delays revealing his secrets or what really his intention was when he took the film in the first place. But he goes to travel the world. And he goes to Southeast Asia.
Who is he working for at this time?
Nobody. He's now he's a traveling man. He's a free agent. He travels the world. He tries to get into the Soviet Union. He goes to Europe. Life was good. He had money to spend. He didn't.
He had money. He was a single guy, right?
He was a single guy. Had a few girlfriends on his world travels.
Israel beer.
Okay, yeah. and he ends up in Australia. And in Australia, he has a religious awakening, and he converts to the Anglican Church of Australia. And he changes his name to John Crossman. He works as a busboy and a taxi driver in Australia for a while. And, well, his parents disowned him. When he revealed Israel's secrets, his parents dissociated from him, although his siblings, two of his brothers, still maintain contact with him to this day. So he's now an Anglican Christian in Australia, talking with journalists. And one of his buddies, a Colombian journalist, tells him after Vanunu reveals his knowledge of nuclear secrets from Israel, he says, "Oh, that you could fetch $1 million for that kind of information. Why don't you shop it around to the various news outlets and you become a wealthy man?" Now, he doesn't do it right away, but he thinks about it, and eventually he decides, okay, he's going to do it. Who does he turn to? He turns to the Sunday Times, British newspaper, and the journalist who he deals with is Peter Hunam. They meet in London, and the information is given over. The developed photographs are given over. The arrangement is that Vanunu will be paid $100,000. Not $1 million, $100,000. Which is a nice amount of money by the standards of 1986. But he never gets the money. Why? Because the Sunday Times was suspicious that maybe this wasn't real. Maybe this is a hoax. they had been bamboozled once before with the Hitler diaries. This is before my time, but in the early 80s, there were infamous Hitler diaries that were totally fake. And they had paid good money for that. And this was not a trashy tabloid. This was a reputable paper. If they're going to print a major story about Israel's nuclear program, it has to all check out. So they went to Theodore Taylor, who was an American expert on nuclear weapons, and he was able to confirm that, yes, these photographs are real. They're from a nuclear facility, and they depict what Vanunu was claiming to be the case. But while that was going on, Vanunu was getting a little antsy, and he wanted the story printed, and he wanted to make money. So he also turned to the Daily Mirror, which was a trashy tabloid, which was owned by Robert Maxwell. Now, Robert Maxwell, a Czech-born Jew in 1923, served in the British Army, and then was an important figure in the running of guns between Czechoslovakia and Israel between 1947 and 1949. Yesh Omrim, those who say that Maxwell was a Mossad agent for the next 20 years. Nobody knows for sure. No one also knows why he fell off his boat in 1991 and was dead. Either he just drowned because he had a heart attack and fell off the side, or someone pushed him. He's a mysterious life, including a stint as the owner of the New York Post. Alexander Hamilton himself was crying on the cover of the Post when Maxwell owned it. All right. So Maxwell tips off the State of Israel that this Mordechai Vanunu character is spilling the beans on the nuclear project. And so Israel is aware of Vanunu's act of treason even before the Sunday Times prints the story on October 5th, 1986. So what do? They got to catch Vanunu somehow. But he's in England. And the Israelis don't want to offend the British. They have done that a few too many times. Shimon Peres, who is the prime minister at this point, wants to catch Vanunu because Peres, as the granddaddy of the nuclear project, feels betrayed that one of his employees spilled the beans. So he's going to get that guy. Prosecute him. And when Peres was emphatic about getting him, he used a few salty words in telling his underlings, we're going to get that guy. So they hatch a plot to lure him out of England to another country from which he could then be grabbed and brought to Israel. So they use Cindy. Who is Cindy? So Cindy, her real name was Cheryl Hanin Ben-Tov. She was an American Jew from Pennsylvania, actually from Florida. And she went on a post-high school trip to Israel in 1978, fell in love with the country, and decided to move to Israel. She gets recruited by the Mossad in 1985, and is a married woman, by the way, married to Ofer Ben-Tov, when this is all happening. Which leads to an interesting question, whether or not the Mossad allows for sexual liaisons between their operatives and the general public, especially if that female operative is a married woman. Supposedly, a great rabbi was asked this question, and he gave an evasive answer, other than to point to that Esther was married to Achashverosh, and that Yael was in a liaison with Sisera, even though she was Eshet Chever HaKeni. Okay, so, that rabbi also said that I don't think they're really asking the question of us. They're going to do whatever they're going to do. So she goes to Europe and strikes up a relationship with Vanunu. She pretends to be an American tourist backpacking across Europe and tells Vanunu, I'm going to Rome. Why don't you meet me there in a few days? And that's what happens. He is lured to Rome, takes a flight from London to Rome, is going to go to meet Cindy at the apartment, and as soon as he knocks on the door, three Mossad agents knock him down and tranquilize him. They take him to a speedboat, which is waiting right off the coast. It takes him to an Israeli naval freighter, and once on the Israeli naval ship, there's a problem now. They want to make sure that none of the sailors, these 19-year-old boys who were on the ship, that nobody sees Vanunu. Just like in the Eichmann case, they wanted to make sure that Eichmann didn't see his captor, so they made him wear goggles. In this case, they don't want the sailors to see Vanunu. So they quickly whisk him into a basement cabin, a bottom cabin of the ship, and he can see nobody, and nobody can see him other than the two guys from the Mossad who were escorting him, and they bring him to Israel. And he gets to Israel right around the same time as the story breaks in the Sunday Times in London. Okay. Well, Israel doesn't want Vanunu to have a public forum to be able to say his, you know, his piece to the media. So they're careful that this is going to be a secret trial, that nobody has access to the guy. But famously, what does he do to get the word out? The famous photograph of Mordechai Vanunu is with his hands. He takes his hands and presses it against the glass, the tinted window of the police van that was taking him from prison to the court. And on his hand was written, Vanunu M, hijacked flight to Rome, with the flight number 93086. So, the press are taking pictures, and they see his hand, and they see it's all written there, and they know that's him, and what happened to him. Okay, so there's a trial. The trial concludes in 1988 in February with a conviction. So this was pretty much a foregone conclusion that he would be convicted. No, it's not a capital crime. In Israel, there only are two capital crimes: crimes against humanity and crimes against the Jewish people. This is the revealing of state secrets and violation of a non-disclosure agreement with an employer. So he gets 18 years, starting from the day of his incarceration or capture. So he's up for release in 2004, but he's up for parole as early as 1998. Parole was, of course, denied. He serves 11 years in solitary confinement from 1986 to 1997. No. It's very important to recognize that he is not an Australian citizen. He is a citizen only of the State of Israel, which will play an important role after his release from jail in preventing him from leaving the country. Okay. So, his lawyer is Avigdor Feldman. I don't know if that name means anything to you, but Avigdor Feldman is like the Lynn Stewart of Israel. Is the one who defends all the worst characters, the terrorists, the ones who hate the country. So Feldman is protesting vigorously that the fact that Vanunu is being harshly treated, that he didn't really do anything so terrible, he revealed information that everyone knows anyway, this was not a secret anymore, and why is he getting solitary confinement? This is un-Jewish and un-Israeli. Okay, that's his criticism of the system. Well, in 2004, he's ready to be released. But the State of Israel has to figure out, how do we prevent this guy from revealing further information? I mean, he may still know things that are damaging to the state. So one approach is to say that he doesn't know anything at this point. Like Pollard, what does Pollard know now? It was the argument. It's been 30 years, he doesn't know anything that's damaging anymore. So with Vanunu, he knew secrets of the Israeli nuclear program from the mid-80s. It's now the mid-2000s. So what could he possibly tell that he didn't tell already? That was an argument in his favor to have him released with no restrictions on his movement or his activities. But it was rejected by the defense establishment. And the person who was most responsible for limiting Vanunu's activities was Yechiel Chorev. Yechiel Chorev is not a household name. He was the Malmab, which is the Hebrew acronym for the Director of Security of the Defense Establishment. It's basically the guy who keeps everyone in line who works for the defense, that they shouldn't reveal information that is meant to be kept secret. And he was the head of that department from 1986 to 2007. He felt partly responsible that under his watch in the first year of his service the leak happened. So he wants to make sure this guy who was guilty of it never is able to live a normal life and cannot do any further damage. Furthermore, Shimon Peres wants to make sure that Mordechai Vanunu doesn't leak any further information and doesn't have a normal life, or an enjoyable life for that matter. So, what are the restrictions on his behavior? Well, number one, he cannot leave the country for the next 12 months. And at the end of 12 months, he has to apply for the right to get a passport, and that right could be denied with a further 12-month extension on the limitation of his movement. So what has happened? Every year for the past 12 years, at the end of the 12-month cycle, they renew the ban on his outside travel, that he cannot get a passport. Okay. He also cannot talk to foreigners. He cannot talk to the press without prior permission from the security services. He cannot go within 500 meters of an international frontier, and he cannot go to a port of entry. Yeah. He cannot have a cell phone, and he has his internet activity is being monitored.
Like me.
But even so, he knows people. I mean, today it's okay. Simple.
Okay, so let's see what happens.
Where's he living?
Okay, all right. These are all good questions. They're all good questions. So, no, he doesn't live in Cedars. So his name is Mordechai Vanunu, but he doesn't like the name Mordechai. Because he doesn't like anything Jewish. When he comes out of prison, he is greeted by a crowd of supporters, international leftists and you know, Israel haters, who feel that he did a good thing in exposing evil Israel's nuclear secrets, and a counter party of a few hundred Israeli patriots who were there to throw tomatoes at him. And there was a press conference. He wanted to have it outside the gates of the prison, but it was too dangerous for his own safety to have it outside the gates of the prison, so it was within the prison yard just before he got into his limo to leave.
Limo.
Provided for by friends from abroad. And in which he said, in broken English, why broken English? Because he refuses to speak Hebrew. From that day forward, he refuses to speak Hebrew. So he uses broken English. He said that he was not a traitor, that he did what was in the best interest of humanity, because for Israel to have nuclear weapons is a danger to the world. And so he didn't mean to harm the country of his citizenship, which he doesn't like to mention Israel by name, but he was a tzaddik, that he did it all for all the right reasons. All the right reasons. Okay, so where does he go? He lives in St. George's Cathedral, in East Jerusalem, an Anglican church, and because he is a now devout Anglican, he gets to live in the cathedral. He rejects Judaism, and he rejects the legitimacy of a Jewish state. He says there doesn't need to be a Jewish state. There needs to be a Palestinian state, but the Jews could live anywhere in the world. Okay. So, Peter Hunem, who feels a little bit guilty that the story which he published in the Sunday Times got this guy arrested and spent 18 years in jail, including 11 in solitary. He feels bad about what happened. He wants to meet Vanunu and do like a follow-up story. So he goes to Israel in 2004 and is there at Vanunu's release in the crowd, but can't get close enough to speak to him because the security services won't allow it. So in May, about a month later, he has a sit-down with him in a cafe somewhere, and the Shin Bet knows it's happening, and they arrest Hunem, and they put him in jail. Now, this is not a good thing for the state of Israel.
Why arrest the reporter?
Why not?
So, because the reporter is violating Vanunu's parole orders. In America, that might have been a valid logic. This is Israel. This is Israel, and in Israel, sometimes twisted logic works. So the Sharon government realized very quickly that this was not good for PR sake to arrest a journalist for meeting with Vanunu. It's one thing to be tough on Vanunu, but you can't arrest a foreign citizen just for sitting down and having coffee and telling stories. So after a couple days in jail, he was released and left and never came back. Okay, but what about Vanunu himself? He wants to tell his story, but he's not allowed. So every now and then, he gets arrested for violating his parole orders. And in 2007, he was arrested and He was sent before a judge. They thought it was going to be another slap on the wrist. They sent him to 6 months in jail. So Feldman, the lawyer, says this is a disgrace. The guy's already done his, you know, paid his debt to society. What are you putting him in jail again for 6 months? But he served. Then in 2010, he was arrested again for some violation of his parole orders, and he spent 3 months in jail. So he's not the kind of guy, Vanunu, who is looking to have a comfortable existence and stay out of trouble. He's an ideologue who really believes that he was doing, you know, the right thing, and he's crazy, and he continues to do it. Okay, so he wants to leave the country, but Israel doesn't want him to leave the country. And Yossi Lapid, or Tommy Lapid, was the justice minister in 2004 in the Sharon government. And he, the Holocaust survivor that he was, a firm believer in Israel's nuclear program and a vigorous defense of the state, hated Vanunu with a passion and facilitated the implementation of these tough standards of parole. So, too bad for Vanunu. But what if he is able to renounce his Israeli citizenship and leave the country because some other country is willing to have him?
Is that legal?
Okay. So the law in the state of Israel is that you are allowed to renounce your citizenship, but if and only if you already have citizenship in another country, which Vanunu didn't. So he tried to get it, but he was unsuccessful because applying for political asylum in Scandinavian countries where he was most interested in moving can only be done if you're already in that country. If you've crossed the border and are now resident on their territory, you can apply for asylum and get some kind of citizenship. But he's stuck in Israel. He can't get out. So he's in a position where others might be willing to take him, but he can't get there. And because he can't get there, Israel can coerce him to maintain Israeli citizenship. Eli Yishai of the Shas party was the interior minister in 2011 when this was all happening, and he enforced the law. You're a citizen, you can't escape the citizenship because of your personal circumstances, so too bad, you're not going anywhere. Okay.
You could go into an embassy?
He could try to pull, what's his name, Julian Assange,
yeah, right,
but he didn't. He has not done that, and it really wouldn't help him much, because what's going to happen then? He'll be stuck in an embassy? At least if he lives in St. George's Cathedral, he can travel around the country. He doesn't like being in Israel, but at least it's a country. Okay, so he's 62 now. So in 2015, he got married. He got married to a shiksa. He married Kristen Joachimson, who is a professor of political science and philosophy in Oslo. And that's the connection to Norway. So he wants to go to Norway, but he can't, so she moved temporarily to Israel, and now it's a long-distance relationship. Okay. What happened to Cindy? Okay, that's a great question. So, yeah. I don't know why they employed a married woman, but if you look her up, if you Google her, if you Google Cheryl Bentov, you will find that she's a real estate salesperson in Clearwater, Florida. She moved out of Israel. She has a husband and two daughters and lives a normal existence in the United States. However, if you go to the Arab media sites, they suggest that even after she resigned from the Mossad in the late 80s, she continued to work for them as a spy in the United States, even to this very day. And the evidence for that is that there was some tinkering with her real estate broker's license. Things were deleted or added. Something was a little fishy about the paperwork of her professional practice here in the United States, leading conspiracy theorists in the Arab world to say that she is violating the Israeli-American understanding that Mossad operatives don't work in the United States. That's a long-standing policy that Israel doesn't spy directly and on U.S. soil. I think that's Narishkeit, like Arab propaganda. But, all right, so she lives in America, and you can even find a picture of her and her husband that was taken out that long ago. So she's a regular human being like the rest of us, yeah.
If you marry someone from another country, you can't go to that person's country?
No.
Yeah. Well, he could go to Norway, but he can't leave Israel.
That's what I meant.
So, now, the other interesting wrinkle...
But is she allowed to live in Israel because she's not an Israeli citizen?
So she's married to an Israeli citizen, but... And I don't know the particulars of this, but there's a bit of a problem, because the marriage happened in the state of Israel since Venunu couldn't leave, and it's an intermarriage which is unlawful and was not solemnized by a clergyman, and on the assumption that even though he's an apostate, he's still technically a Jew, the Rabbanut couldn't do it, so I don't know if he's legally married.
Who cares?
No, it does matter in the sense that if she wants to live in the state of Israel, in order to get in on a consistent basis as opposed to on a tourist visa, it would matter if they were legally married or not. And I don't know the answer to that question.
But were there actual consequences to the information that he revealed?
Okay. So did it matter that he revealed anything? You could make a strong case that that's the most important question this evening. However, on the other hand, maybe it doesn't matter at all, because if a nuclear weapon has not been used in all this time, does it really matter that people have a greater awareness or are more confirmed in their suspicions than they were in 1985 or 1975? And does it matter whether there are thermonuclear weapons or not, or whether there are 85 nuclear warheads or there are 400? These are just numbers that have no real consequence to anyone, unless, God forbid, something were to actually happen. But since it never did, maybe none of this matters. There was a book written about espionage in the Cold War, whether or not any of that stuff ever made any difference whatsoever. And the author's argument is none of it ever mattered, because the real life and death struggles happened in third world countries, or Korea and Vietnam, where there were boots on the ground and guys dying in the thousands. But there was no espionage there. It was just war. Espionage was between smart guys who wear thick glasses and go between Moscow and New York and Washington and the like, and all that was just game playing, and it didn't really matter. Okay? Whether I think that, I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah.
After he revealed it, why doesn't Israel sign the non-proliferation agreement, a nuclear treaty?
I think that Israel continues to believe that there are benefits to ambiguity. What those benefits are, I'm not really sure, but the policy remained in place. The policy remained in place, and it could theoretically is still in place. But the addendum to all that is the Begin Doctrine, which is Israel will not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons, but it also won't be the second country to introduce them. Nobody's going to get them. We may or may not have them, and you definitely won't have them. So the Iraqis get blown up at Oss Irak, the Syrians get blown up by Olmert in 2007 outside Damascus, and various shenanigans with Unit 8200 and the cyber warfare and the killing of scientists in the Tehran program. So that's been the policy. We may or may not have it, but you definitely won't have it. Yeah.
Didn't anybody complain that the film was stolen? Or were they so embarrassed that they didn't want to say anything?
Why would they know?
When he originally was prosecuted, took the film.
Oh, no. It's not that he stole film.
He took pictures.
with his own camera. Okay, yeah.
What about with Egypt? Egypt wants them to disarm their nuclear facility, and Egypt would want to introduce their own. Does that play into any of this stuff? And also the United States now with Israel's... how much knowledge does the United States know about what goes on in Israel?
I don't know. I mean, I would assume that the United States works with the assumption that Israel still has a significant number of warheads, although they stopped production about 10 years ago. Or at least so it is claimed, they stopped production in about 2005 because they had enough. I mean, I don't know what the shelf life is of a nuclear bomb, but I don't know.
Aren't there advanced versions of those things?
the advancements are in the ballistics missiles technology, the delivery systems. Those continue to be developed over time, and Israel has the nuclear triad. It has primarily by submarine, but also intercontinental ballistic missiles from the ground and from the air, from planes, although that's the least significant of the three. The most significant is a submarine because it's a good second strike option in case the country gets hit. Okay, now one last point before we stop. Vanunu is a hero to many people. He's a villain to the people in this room, probably, but we're on the topic of heroes and villains, so you can understand why, for those in the international community who have an axe to grind against Israel and are, and generally speaking, pacifists and against nuclear arms and want to see the abolition of all nuclear weapons from the face of the earth, that he is a tzaddik yesod olam. So he would be annually put forth as a candidate for the Nobel Peace Prize. Okay. But he, in 2009, he declined his the candidacy. He told his supporters, "Do not put me forth as a candidate for the for Nobel Peace Prize, because a prior winner of that was Shimon Peres, his arch enemy." And he says, "I don't want to be in the same company as Shimon Peres." And with that, we'll conclude.